Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yuggera, Turrbal and Yugrupul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Noonuckle, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners, tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, a beautiful day, blue sky, sunshine. What more could you want? Well, there is a bit more to life than that, isn't there? Well, today's guest is Ross Watson, Uncle Ross Watson. He's my mum's, one of my mum's younger brothers. Ross is the founder of the Murray School. It's been in operation now for some 28 years, I think it is, out there at Acacia Ridge. He's also the founder of 98.9 FM, the radio station, which started out as Murray Hour on 4ZZZ back in about 83, 84. He's the man responsible for writing up the licence application for the 98.9 FM, which also involved or demanded that funding be arranged, the submissions, the appropriate amount of funding to buy all that equipment from scratch, to build a radio station from scratch. And Ross Watson is the man behind that. He managed the station for some 5 or 6 years, might have been a few years longer. Once we started broadcasting, we just celebrated our 20th anniversary of being on air. But Ross led us through that early period of being a full-time broadcaster with our own license. The second and largest capital city broadcaster, the second First Nations license in the country, and the largest capital city broadcaster in the country today. Uncle Ross, how are you?
I'm good, Tig. I'm sitting out in the sun here enjoying this lovely morning, mate. I'm out in the driveway, and I'm just hoping not too many cars go past the street. But
that's all right. All adds
in the sun.
All adds to the atmosphere of things. But now it's a beautiful day.
Yeah.
Tell us your mob, your country.
Yeah, I'm a Dawson River Murray. Kungaloo clan, I suppose, of the Gungaloo Nation, I think, that takes in the most of the Dawson River and on my mum's side. And then on my dad's side, we're Birriggubba. And we're one of the three or four families that we know of, the Wirri clan there from the Birriggubba. And they're also in amongst the Wirri clan, the Birriggubba Nation, there was about 16 or 18 clan groups in there. Our grandmother was actually from Birria country, the clan land that takes in the Whitsundays.
All right.
So we've got some connections in to country up there too, North Queensland way.
Mm.
Yeah, but I'm a Dawson River Murray. I grew up there. Dad brought us up in our mum's country, same as your dad brought you up on the Dawson.
Mm.
Same way the in your mother's country.
You did your primary school and high school there, and you went on to boarding school.
Yeah, went to St. Brendan's. I went my pre-primary school. Mum was always a strong Catholic. She used to spend at least 40 minutes three times a day, after morning smoko, after lunch, and afternoon smoko. She'd always spend 30 or 40 minutes with the Bible. And that was like her meditation. I think it got her helped her live her life. And I ended up being an altar boy there with the Catholic Church. And there was a priest come along. His name was Father Frank Arthurs. And he spoke to the good people around Theodore, and they passed the hat around, and they managed to get me into St. Brendan's when I was just before I turned 15 in 1959, I think it was, my first year there. I was there until I turned 18. I left there, I completed year 12 there, which was called senior, Queensland senior examination in those days. But even though we're going about the redneck society that we grew up in the racist times, there was always that element of goodwill in people, that the people around Theodore and in the Dawson, they were prepared to contribute to the education of a young Murray kid. And that now allowed me to stay at the boarding school until I turned 18 and did my senior there.
That would have been one of the first situation of this type where a Murray from the Dawson went into boarding school. What are your thoughts?
Probably one of the first. I never heard of any before me. I know there was a young fella, he went from Moorabbinda. I can't think of his name, and I think he went to St. Brendan's in about 10 years after me, I think. And he actually, he followed my tracks a little bit. I believe his family told me he was the first Murray to captain St. Brendan's first 13. Undefeated in the season. And I said, no, he's the second one. We just didn't make a big lot of noise about it back then when I come through. Yeah. But there was another young Murray come through from Moorabbinda and did that.
All right.
For sure.
Now, did you go on a uni then? Did you have a crack at uni straight out of high school?
I had a go at it. I enrolled in Arts Law, Queensland Uni, but couldn't settle in. I'd had enough of the 4 years of the boarding school was pretty much enough for me. The older I got there, the longer I got to leave in the place, the more I realised that there wasn't a real lot in the society that I could aspire to. There wasn't a place for me, and it was a bit hard. I couldn't really fit into the university in Brisbane, the lifestyle and the big smoke. It was, I was still more suited to the scrub, I think. Yeah.
So many, many, many years later, you decide to do a PhD.
I was driving a cab for about 10 years. I was doing a night shift. And of course, in a night shift, you've got plenty of time to think about things. And I realised there was things I wanted to say that I was looking more and more at the things our parents and family had taught me that I hadn't passed on sufficiently. And that I'd yarned to a bloke named Victor Hart, and he was running the Yujiru unit at the time at Kelvin Grove, and Victor helped me enrol there. And I started my degree there in 2004, and that's because I was getting out that airplane. You picking up that airplane?
Yeah, but it's all right. It all adds to the atmosphere of the situation. All right. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, the closer I got to turning 60, the more I realised doing night shift in the cab, the harder and harder them young fellas are going to be able to take the control when they get drunk on weekends. And I thought, I've got to look at something else now. So I started thinking about study and writing. And a week before I turned 60, I started my first, lecture at QUT in creative writing. Yeah.
All right. We'll come back to that. Along the way, I introduced you as the founder of the Murray School and the founder of this radio station, 98.9 FM, which started out as Murray Hour on Triple Z back in the early to mid-80s. But the Murray School, that's some 28 years old. What led you to think 28 years ago that we need our own school?
I used to work with an organisation for a brief time, though, I worked with an organisation called the Brisbane Youth Service. It's a marvellous organisation. It was started off by a young fellow named Michael Tansky, a young non-Indigenous fellow, but he had a lot of respect for Indigenous people. And him and his partner, Maureen, they were very influential and supportive to the young Murray kids around the streets of Brisbane who were disaffected and disconnected. And I worked there for a while, and I learned about the numbers of our young kids who were into glue sniffing and petty crime around the streets, and some of the reasons why they didn't go home and wouldn't go home, couldn't go home, and sad reasons that we don't have to talk about now. But I learned about some of that stuff, and I had a big sister at the time, Lilla Watson, who was working at the University of Queensland in the social work department. And she was working out there with a bloke named Matt Foley, who later on went to Parliament and became a minister in the Goss government. And my big sister, she started saying to me, "You've got to start a Murray school for these kids." And I'd say, "Yeah, okay." And I'd think about it, but I wouldn't think too much about it. And next time I see her a few weeks later, she'd say, "What have you done about starting a Murray school?" And so I went along to Stevie Mam, the NAC National Aboriginal Congress, I think was still going. And Steve used to hold meetings every month for the community. And I went along to one of those meetings, and he gave me time to jump up on the microphone, and I asked for nominations for people who are interested in starting the Murray School for our kids. Because we'd sort of worked it out in discussion with Sister and amongst ourselves that every child, like the United Nations said at that time, they said every child is entitled to an education. But they didn't say that every child is entitled to an education within their culture and community. And we've worked out, no, the United Nations Declaration didn't go far enough. So we said, no, our kids are entitled to an education within their culture or within their community. Because our kids were the lowest performers in all areas of school attendance and achievement. Our kids always hit the bottom of the achievement records and the top of the non-attendance records. So the more my sister spoke to me, the more I was persuaded, and we eventually got a committee together, and eventually we got a school going. And that opened in 1986. With 13 children, and because the school needed funding to carry it for the first 3 months before the appropriate state inspections could be carried out and we could come under state and government funding, we received a donation from the Friendly Society, from the Quakers. And of course that was negotiated by a woman they used to call Supergram, and that was Muriel Langford. And of course Muriel Langford had been involved with Joyce Wilding when they set up the Opal organisation some years previously. But it was Supergran who organised that, gave the school the breathing space to get going so we could get our funding to start the school in 1986. I haven't actually asked her family, but I've got an idea that I wouldn't be surprised if she made most of the donation herself and then blamed the Quakers for it. I don't know. But the Quakers were very helpful too at that time and other times.
She was involved for many years following the establishment of the school too, Super Grand. She was an amazing woman.
Oh yes, no, she was a campaigner and a real fighter. The old lady, a lot of respect for her.
For sure.
Yeah.
So moving along, the radio station, you also saw a need then for radio and to be involved in the media, being able to tell our stories and things?
Yeah, well, that was brought about by those Commonwealth Games in 1982 when old the racist regime we had in the time, they used to, you know, put headlines in the media about a 500-strong army of black fellas going to come down and training in North Queensland, going to come down and disrupt the games. And when it was discovered that that army consisted of one, well, I think it was a Maori, young Maori fella, and a couple of women up there in living in the bush in North Queensland, apparently had a broken 303 rifle that wouldn't work. But according to the media and the government of the day in Queensland, he was a 500-strong army going to cause bloodshed and chaos in Brisbane streets when those games were on. When it was discovered, the truth was discovered, there was no apologies to our people. There was no explanation, discussion of the lies told, of the bad will generated. No in-depth discussion from the media of the day. There was no in-depth discussion of the motives of the government, or the disgraceful plight our community was in under the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Acts, which were enforced at that time. And those acts, of course, they legalised government or slavery of our people, forcing people to work without wages. And even today, the successive governments have failed to return those stolen wages to any of our people. And it's a bit of a disgrace, but we had nowhere to, no platform to talk on, to express our view, to express the truth of the situation, or even to play our music that we love. And, you know, sort of we just pointed out the crying need for a platform for our perspectives, our culture, and to try to, I suppose, expose the hypocrisy of the system in the way they dealt with our people and the way they addressed our issues. So that's sort of the reason behind, you know, starting a campaign to set up the Murray Radio.
You started out with an hour pre-recorded program on 4ZZZ. They're still going strong. We've come a long way in this period. We just celebrated 20 years of being on air with our own license, which you took control of, or took responsibility for, not control of. You took responsibility for writing an application so that we got our own license. It wasn't good enough. You obviously thought we could do better than by visiting another radio station for an hour or two or ten. It grew to about 15 or 20 hours a week or more. But you took responsibility to see that we got our own license by writing up a submission and organising the funding.
Yes, yeah, well, that was me particularly because of the goodwill and commitment of the 4ZZZ cooperative. They gave us such a chunk of the airtime that it was sort of a little bit not quite right to take so much of their time. Then they also got a lot of pressure put on them because of our rantings and ravings against the racism of the system. They were very, very strong and very committed. But it wasn't quite proper to not to try and set up our own station. And it was the support from our community. It made that application so necessary. If our community hadn't been so full on in support and commitment to what we were doing with the with our media, there wouldn't have been a real sort of drive to continue with that application process. But the support from our mob was so strong, we had no choice really. We had to go ahead that way.
When you look around now, we see a national network of First Nations communities, Aboriginal, Torres Strait mob, some 120 plus communities that have radio broadcast facilities. We've come a long way in that time, and it's largely due to the initiative which you and others took in Brisbane. It's largely due to that community initiative and community demand, and here we are some 30 years later, when we see this growth and this expansion and development and commitment from our mob. Must be encouraging, must be heartening.
Oh, yeah. It's great. I mean, I remember those days when we was in the funding drought, or in the funding area, that we were the fair-skinned fellas on the southeast corner. They cut that country diagonally between Darwin, Alice Springs and Townsville, and they left us on the bottom. And they reckon the real black fellas up top, and they're the ones entitled to the funding, not us. And we used to imagine the day when we'd have a network where we could put one program on air and share it between us, all of us, all around the country. And we used to dream about that. And I've got to turn it back on you, mate, and thank you for that. That's I just started a little fire there, mate. You fanned it. Not only others, all the others involved, everybody.
Yeah, a big mob been involved.
And everybody else fanned it, kept it going, and it's wonderful what you've been able to establish. I just started a little fire there, a little germ of an idea, and it spread. And
well,
it's wonderful.
You've started another fire with your PhD and the writing of the river story. But before we go into that, I'd just like to take a break for a song and come back. I want to pick up on your PhD, the writing of the river story, the message behind the river story, and when people will be able to access that once you get it all finalised, your process of this PhD, which is in its final stages. Uncle Ross, before I go into the river story, need to acknowledge your little team. You had a staunch team that carried on with the radio programming while you were busy writing up the application and doing meetings and negotiating funding.
Very much so, Tig. That was the Croft family and people like Bubbalu Watago and my young brother Charlie Watson, his wife Delwyn, and my sister Lilla, of course. Your mother was always around, but particularly Glenys Croft and her family. They were the backbone of the station, of the Murray Radio before we got the license. And unfortunately, once the funding came through, the relationship didn't continue. Once the funding was there, we was required to operate by more professional standards, and some of us Murrays are more relaxed without timetables and signing on starting sheets and all that sort of, all that sort of stuff.
It was a whole new ball game then, wasn't it, once that money came through?
Well, once the money came through, we had to learn what it was to be professional. And but full respect to the family. Without that family, we would never have got. I would never have been able to keep the thing going on my own, the Murray Radio, the Murray Show.
Yeah.
And it was only because of that family of Glenys Croft and her children, Michelle, Erin, Janine, the young boy Shane, and young Matty. And Bubbalu was always part of them, and part of their family. Young Kerry Ann Watson, cousin brother Charlie Watson from Cherbourg used to be involved at different times as well.
Yes.
A lot of people from community.
Yeah.
They put in a lot of, and the community that used to ring in all the time with the requests for music and community announcements. There was 25 organisations in the community about that time. There was only two organisations that, 23 of those organisations wrote letters of support to our application for the licence.
Mm.
And that was a marvellous effort.
It certainly was. It certainly was.
Yep.
Now, you're in university, you're on the final stages of your thesis, The River Story. I want to play just the first. We've recorded, you wondered, it's not only a written thing, this is a recording. We'll play the first couple of minutes of The River Story and get you to explain it, to tell us what your message is, what drove you to this and what's behind it, if you would. We'll just have a listen now to The River Story.
I am a river. This is my story. I am a crease in the thin surface crust on a cooling blob of molten rock. I was formed many ages ago when the movements of land masses and volcanoes pushed up mountain ranges and peaks in our great Southland. In earlier times, when land rose above the water in different places, my basin land had emerged, flavoured by the mighty Salt Mother, who gave experience of the moon tides and the myriad life forms of the oceans. Sometimes I flowed in different directions, responding to great land movements throughout the ages of my life. But always, my tentacles of thread-like veins and arteries obeyed the natural laws and empowered me through the runoff from my basin's watershed. In secret places, my subsurface channels used to freshen my waters during the dry, and when my levels are high, at some junctions, I sometimes flow in opposite directions at the same time. The creator spirits who cause the undulations in land and sea are best explained in the concepts of my human children. The simplicity of my descriptions may not suit the minds of all people.
We'll pull that up there, but that's the introduction. Your first few words on the river story. It sounded pretty deadly there.
Yeah, I think the spirits, I think they come to me in my dreams sometimes. I woke up one morning, I had to write a 10,000 word exercise for the creative writing thing at the QUT. And I woke up one morning and those words were on my lips. I am a river. This is my story. And I thought about that and then I came up with what I've continued on with there.
How many thousand words is it going to be when you present it?
The story itself should be close to 50,000, or a minimum of 50,000 to 80,000. They probably won't use everything, all right.
Hmm.
My supervisor will decide that.
What's the structure of it? Why? What is the purpose of the river story? You're telling a story like from creation. Through the river, yes. The river's doing the talking for us.
Yeah, I think, Tigers, because setting up the Murray School and the Murray Radio, that was a response to a racist system that had put our people at a disadvantage. With the river story, we're looking at a different situation. There was a song the Wurrumpi Band used to put it out. I can't remember the name of the song, but some of the lines in the song, they said... The ship called Mother Earth is sinking, and when the ship's sinking, it's all hands on deck.
Was that Got to Be Strong?
That might be it. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. Yeah.
Yeah, but the message there is pretty clear. When the ship's sinking, it's all hands on deck and differences put aside. And I'm very much aware of visits to home country and the parks and gardens around Mount Cutha, Tui Forest here in Brisbane. All the country I see now, it's dying. It's not healthy. And it's very, very obvious that the governments and the parks and wildlife people don't know how to look after it, because the country needs to be burnt every year, or regulated, much more regularly than it is. And it's a terrible neglect of country that we see, and a terrible damage to the species and the wildlife, plant species and wildlife species. A terrible ignorance, and it's not the fault of people, of individuals. It's the fault of the system, because the system is driven by the economy. And there's a need for people to understand where these problems originate from and why people are divided so terribly. And to do that, I've tried to take people to give them provide a reading of country, an understanding of country, and an understanding of our culture that's based on immersion in country, in nature, in the things that allowed us to evolve as the human species. And that's something that the system doesn't provide us, the economy doesn't provide us, the media doesn't provide us, the governments and ministers don't provide us. It's the... I've tried to provide a background, particularly to the advent of agriculture, which many learned people today still say is what makes people human. And they've never seen outside agriculture, they've never seen enough to know that it's agriculture that destroys people's humanness. It doesn't enhance it, and it's not an evolutionary step forward to practice agriculture. It's a great destructive step backwards. It's the beginning of a terrible ecocide. It's destroyed something like 4 to 4.5 to 5 billion acres of beautiful land across our planet in the last 10,000 years. And the fact that we know they're not learning, because when we look at things now, in the last 40 years up to 2008, 30% of the usable land remaining has been destroyed. So the system's not learning. The system's got no intention of ceasing or correcting its activities. And people need to understand this. And I thought the best way I can provide this explanation is through what I'm trying to provide in the river story. It's one way of trying to put all people on the same page and make people realise that tism, it's produced things like chiefs, leaders, rulers, tyrants, armies and warfare, and of course an economy. There's a great need to understand that those things are not natural to the human condition. If they were, we would never have evolved from the ancient ancestor creatures would never have been able to come down from the trees if those sorts of concepts were actually viable. Because they're not viable.
All right. I've got a caller on the line. Peter would like to make a statement or ask a question. Peter, welcome to Let's Talk. How are you?
Yeah, good, Tiger. How's yourself?
Very, very well. Very well, my friend. What would you like to say?
Welcome to your guest there. I find it very interesting. I'm very interested in his remark just then, where he states that agriculture cannot be seen as a necessary step on the evolutionary ladder, but in a way, I tend to agree with him. It depends which way you look at things. You know, like all our history books and our anthropology books and whatnot tell us that, you know, the big leap forward by humankind was the agriculture development. You know, in the first settlement. Mm. But on the other hand, I can see where he's coming from. He's, it, you know, it, it's it's not right what we're doing, you know, with what we're doing to our environment, that's for sure, you know. So, yeah, I just want to say that.
Good on you, mate.
It's an interesting take, but I don't think the mainstream society or the educational system is going to agree with him. But and oh, yeah, quickly, where can I buy his book or get his book? Because that river story sounds interesting.
You'll hear more of it in coming weeks, the next month or so. You'll hear more of it. It will be put to air in segments as well, so you will be able to buy the story, yes.
Yeah, sure. All right.
Hey, thanks for your call, Peter. You have a good day, man.
Okay, bye.
Bye, mate.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. In response to that, there was a thing in the newspapers about 2 or 3 years ago, 2010, I think it was, a young archaeological PhD student from America. They used the satellite imaging, and they discovered, they identified, I think it was more than 2,000 or 3,000 buried cities and towns under the Sahara Desert. They also identified more than 1,000 burial sites under the Sahara Desert. Now, nobody builds cities and towns in desert sand. The Sahara Desert was not a desert originally. It must have been one of the most beautiful places on the planet, and thousands of years ago. And to imagine that people built all these thousands of cities and towns in desert sand means that we're all crazy, because nobody in their right minds would do it. It's not feasible. It's not possible.
Mm.
In the Holy Land, there's something like more than 100 buried cities and towns. If they want to look in Mesopotamia, if they want to look along the old Silk Route between Europe and Asia, there's a desert there. I'm not sure the name of it. There's around the city of Koh Tan. I believe there's more than 400 to 500 buried cities and towns. Now, these are in the big deserts, and those big deserts are not formed by people living with nature in a natural situation. Those cities and towns are buried because of agriculture. Agriculture is not sustainable. We grew up, we used to have to burn our burning off country in our mother's country in the Dawson. We used to burn all these beautiful species of plant and animal and all the little things. A lot of them are gone now. We sometimes see the kutcha bees, the little ones. We see them here in Brisbane. It's where Mount Kutha got its name from.
That's a native bee, a little blackfellow.
Yeah. And up there they also used to have a bee. When I started school, it was called the carver bee. I named my boy after them. But we don't see the carver bee no more. Sometimes we find the kutcha bee. But that's just a couple of species. There's all these species that are not found anymore. And it's there's books written about a thing called ecocide. And it's the things that destroy species.
Do you think the environment, the plants, have they missed this carver bee and kutcha bee? I mean, what was their, what are your thoughts there? I remember you telling me stories about this little bee.
Yeah, no, well, there's a lot of those things they don't grow no more. The big English bee, the stinging bee, he's too big to pollinate the little plants and flowers, so they don't grow anymore.
So he had a very specific role, that little tiny fella, little black one.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of them can't grow anymore. They're forced out, but the role of agriculture is to denude the earth or country of other species, so the only things grown give the rulers the power of controlling the food supply of humans, and that's how they introduced slavery. That's where slavery came about. Agriculture came with slavery. Otherwise, nobody in their right mind would kill every other species just to privilege 2 or 3 or half a dozen species that's going to keep them on a restricted diet for the rest of the time of creation. nobody in the right mind to do it. Only greedy, very greedy, very powerful people with very small amount of humanness in their makeup would ever dream of such a thing as agriculture. When you consider that every person, when they started agriculture, every person was born into a situation where they knew every plant, every insect, every animal, every food source was known. Why restrict their food supply to just a few dozen species or a dozen species? It doesn't make sense. The only sense it makes is if there are powerful usurpers who want to make other people slaves and introduce the concept of parasitism. And it's that concept of parasitism or monarchy or whatever you want to call it. And that's where that's why agriculture came about. There's no one in their right minds would do ecocide on so many species just for the power over what people eat. Over their food.
So this
no one in the right minds.
This term then, democracy. What are your thoughts? It's just perpetuating the system?
Well, the democracy is a bit of a was a marvelous thing. It's a marvelous thing as a step away from slavery. But it's never meant to stay there. The only true way of natural way. If you're going to get rid of slavery or pretend slavery, is to allow everybody's opinion to prevail and a form of representative government, if you want to call it whatever, but a lifestyle that allows everybody's opinions to be taken into account. Democracy doesn't do that. It divides people. It divides opinions. It allows corruption. It makes a police force necessary, and it allows warfare, and it allows greed, and it allows slavery.
So the alternative, the option then, is a system that some sort of an economy that focuses on, as you've said in the past, respect, healthy living, goodwill, relationships.
Yes.
Is that possible?
Relations. It's possible. That's how the ancient ancestor creatures were able to come down from trees. If they didn't have respect and goodwill amongst them, they would have stayed in the trees. And a lot of them, there's about a dozen species that got up on two legs and started to walk around. They call them hominids, humanoid sort of type creatures. A lot of them are now, did become extinct. We're the last ones and the most destructive ones because of us. It's because of this terrible system that's been imposed and the all-embracing power of that system that's manifested itself in the history of colonialism that we see what's happened to countries all around the planet.
With the system of colonialism, then, for it to maintain its control and power, there's a hell of a lot of racism and racist attitudes there. Is that part of keeping control? I mean, when we see such wrongs like our people dying in jails and tens of millions of dollars spent on royal commissions into deaths in custody and things like that, and still come out with nothing, and we know that this is just not right. How do you explain that?
Racism is a necessary tool of the system. Without racism, you're going to find it very hard to have wars. So the warmongers, the munition industry is going to, it might go broke. Now, if the munition industry is connected to the media, and media is somewhere between 10 and 15 or maybe 20% of the overall economy, then it can't be impartial. It's got to support those things, and racism then becomes a tool. The judiciary, the legal system, it becomes a tool. There's, you know, they can't count up. They can't tell you. Google up and try to find out how many laws we're subject to walking around the streets here in Brisbane. They can't tell you. Somewhere between 500,000 and a couple of million laws. They can lock any of us up for any reason, any time they want to. There's enough laws out there, they'll find something if they want it. It's controlling people. If they direct more of that control and keep the difference, point out the differences between black and white, they need racists in the system. So we start talking together and identify our common concerns, which is clean air, clean water, and healthy food for our children, and a healthy, natural environment that our children are entitled to. That's an evolutionary care, and it's called duty of care, a common custodial duty of care to future generations and to our children and their grandchildren.
So that's the real theme and focus of this River Story, is to try to get that message across to people now, to say, have a look around you, look at the system. It's going downhill at a rapid pace, and we're heading towards extinction virtually. Is that how you'd see it?
That's the way it's going. That's why they had to write Armageddon into the scriptures. They had to write it there because they knew what they were doing when they set it up, and they knew what they were doing when they wrote the scriptures.
Well, where does religion play? What's the role of religion? How is that sort of written in, or what's its purpose?
Religion is the way it's like people are spiritual, are naturally spiritual creatures. It's in our genes. We're also naturally sociable creatures. We're congenial. And goodwill is part of that. But that's been diverted by the idea of religion, which points out the differences. It looks at differences and looks at controlling the thoughts of people and the behaviour of people. No slave master wants too much rebellion. It's going to use up too many resources. So the more they can control or influence the thoughts of people, the easier it is to keep control. Religion diverts the goodwill of people and steers it towards the rulers' intentions, and that's why they've written agriculture, herding and mine, herding of domestication and herding of animals, metal extraction from mining processes, all those things that cause all the ecocide and cause all the deserts, all those things. That's why the scriptures were necessary to validate those things. If people want to look at a creator spirit that provides clean air, clean water, clean food, and goodwill, then if they look at the scriptures, they'll see authorized different other things, the things that actually cause ecocide, cause warfare, cause slavery, and destroy goodwill between people.
All right. We've got 2 minutes of the program left before news. It's certainly a fascinating story, the River Story. What's your hopes with it? You want to see it played in segments on the show?
Yes, I'd like to give people the opportunity to say to people, we've got much more in common than our differences, even though our people might be represented 10 times more than our population in the prisons. We might be at the bottom of all the statistics on health, housing, and what they call wealth. We might be on the bottom there, but despite all those differences, we've got much more in common. And the things we've got in common are our future children and their welfare. And once we start identifying those things, there's a very, very simple way to eradicate what they call poverty, what they call homelessness, and what they call unemployment. Those things can be done away with very, very simply.
There's a lot of people looking. There's a lot of people looking for that, and we'll certainly be doing some more talking with you as you wind up your thesis and this river story starts to get out there. But people will be able to buy it. Uncle Ross, thanks for joining us today. It's been a fascinating discussion. I think people will certainly get something out of it.
Thanks, George. Thanks, George.
You have a good day, and keep up the great work. See you then. Uncle Ross Watson joining us. And yes, that will be recorded, will be available. We'll let you know. You keep on listening. Time to go. Have a great day.